Hello, ramblers and gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing, IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. This is episode number 50 of the Rambling and Gambling Pod. If I'm being honest, I never in a million years thought we were going to make it this far. This pod is a two-person operation. Myself and producer Parrish, we're both hard news guys. I'm a reporter. He's a photographer. Lately, we've been spending a ton of time at the Supreme Court covering severe weather, inflation, gas prices. Doing this once a week for the past 50, it's been absolutely awesome. Parrish, who I'm dragging into this again today, when we started this about a year ago, did you ever in a million years think that we would still be doing it now?
I thought it was a great idea. I'm glad you're doing it. Like every week, you put the time in, you put your homework, you're motivated, you drive the ship. I'm just, you're Scottie Pippen, basically.
No. We're I don't even know what the comparison is, but we are a team always. For listeners who don't know, Parrish and I work together every single day, also for our hard news stuff. So thank you very much for what you do. Thank you so much for allowing me to drag you actually onto the pod for the second time in 50 episodes. Ladies and gentlemen, I promise you it is not easy to get Parrish to do this. Also, thank you, of course, to our incredible listeners. We are nothing without the RNG listeners. And thanks to our bosses at Fox 5 DC. Not only do they let a couple of hard news guys do a podcast about gambling, they actually give us the time to do it. I know that sounds simple, but I promise you, In today's TV news world, getting the time to do anything, it's not easy. As for this week's episode, we're starting number 50 the same way we started number one. Captain Jack Andrews is back. Jack's a legend in the gambling community. He's a sharp bettor, but he's also incredibly knowledgeable about the gambling industry overall. He's someone who's definitely not afraid to speak his mind, and people really respect what he has to say. So we're talking to Jack about big picture stuff, how the industry is changing, what that means for us gamblers. Jack's got suggestions for recreational bettors as we head into football season. We'll be talking process, so how to bet, not what to bet. And as part of that, we'll also be talking about Jack's amazing website, unabated.com. After that, we've got Mo DeKeel, who does podcasts for The Athletic. He writes for Bleacher Report. He was a video coordinator for 8 seasons with both the Clippers and the Spurs as well. We're doing a little NBA with him before this pod gets really football-centric really soon, pretty much starting next week. And with the Mo interview, which we just recorded, make sure you stick around till the end for a great Pop story. He worked under Coach Popovich. It's a really good story. Anyway, let's get things started. Episode 50 with Captain Jack. Well, listeners, you know this is a special episode of the pod, because we are calling in one of the greats, the one and only Captain Jack Andrews, who was the first guest we ever had on Rambling and Gambling, and now he's back to lead off episode 50 as well. Jack, how you doing, buddy?
I'm great, Josh. Congratulations on 50 episodes, and it's a pleasure to be back.
I appreciate it, and trust me, the pleasure is all mine. We're happy you're back. Earlier this month, you got back from a vacation, and you posted a series of tweets reflecting on the gambling industry. I've been thinking about them a lot, and I want to delve into them a little bit more. For starters, you said that you are bullish on what's happening in the industry because the current model is failing. Explain that one to me.
Okay, so the current model, which I refer to, and as a lot of people refer to, as a soft book model, a recreational model, it's for operators who want bettors that aren't going to win. They're bettors that don't mind just paying their entertainment tax to bet on sports betting as something they don't intend to win money at. Now, my feeling, Josh, is that sports fans, sports bettors, we want to try to win. And when we don't win, we want to keep trying until we get it right. We try different things. We go about things differently. And what we've seen is a lot of these soft book model operators don't necessarily care for that. If you start to win, or you show inclination of going to win, they tend to limit you down. If you attack them in soft areas of their books, like player props and things like that, they may limit you. So my point was, we've reached a saturation point of these soft book operators. They're all kind of the same. They're all running the same thing. They're all doing the same promotions. They all look the same. And it's time for a change. It's time to the industry to be competitive by innovating in different directions. And that could be a sharper model where they say, okay, we'll take all bets and we'll learn from you. So if you start to get better, we want your action. We want to be able to change the way that we make our lines based on what you think. We're going to use your smarts to be our collective intelligence. And I think we're going to see more of those operators come into the greater market within the U.S., maybe some states sooner than others, but I think we're ready for a pivot.
We had Matthew Metcalf of Circa on a few months back. Circa's probably the most prominent example of a sharp book that's firing on all cylinders right now. Are you expecting more Circas to pop up, more books like Circa? Do you expect the DraftKings and FanDuels of the world to become more like Circa, Circa-ish? Where do you see this going?
I think we will see more sports books like Circa that take that sharp book model. Will we see DraftKings, FanDuel, and the like change the way they do business? Well, that's up to them. There's a lot that goes into that sharp model, and a lot of it is the talent on the other side of the counter doing the bookmaking, identifying the sharp bets, and moving the lines accordingly. That is an art, and there's not a lot of people in this world that have the ability to do it. And so DraftKings, FanDuel, and the like need to decide, do we want to hire those people? Do we want to find and train those people to be able to do this? Or do we want to keep with our status quo? Because we have a pretty big chunk of the market right now, and we're doing just fine. I think what we'll see, Josh, is we may see some of the smaller softbook operators say, okay, we need to make a change in order to compete. Let's go try this sharper book model.
Any timeline for when you expect more of those to come online?
There are a few that'll be into the New Jersey market, which is where I am. They will be in the New Jersey market by football season, so in the next couple months. And that's exciting to me as a bettor here. And they will continue to proliferate across the country where they see they have market access. So there are certain markets that are pretty sealed tight in terms of the available licenses, whereas there are some newer markets opening up like Ohio, Maryland, where there is the ability for new operators to come in. There's lower barriers to entry, and they can apply this sharper book model right from the jump and compete with the big boys.
When you came on last year, we talked a lot about sportsbook promos and how books were basically paying customers to gamble with them. So I thought it was really interesting when you tweeted that picking off promos is going the way of the dinosaur, you said, and that last NFL season was probably peak for promos, and this season will be the rise of the superior product offering. What do you mean by that?
Right. So, yeah, last year we had some great promos. We had Caesars offering $5,000 free bets. We had FanDuel, I think the sign-up was $2,000 at the beginning of last NFL season. And now we're seeing that these companies have said, okay, we're spending too much with this, which they are, and we need to cut it back. And it was sort of like a war of attrition. They want them all to be kind of cooperating. And so far this year, we're seeing that they're all starting to cooperate. The new user sign-up promos have decreased dramatically. It's more like $200 to $500 at the high end. And so I think this NFL season, we're not going to see that big ramp up that we did last year. Now, we may still see some operators, you know, stick their neck out and try something that's a little bit advantageous to bettors. But for the most part, I think what we're transitioning to are competing on things like price and odds boosts. I think odds boosts are kind of a blend there. They're not just giving money away. They're giving money that's advantageous to the bettor, but it's not a ridiculous amount. They do like $50 limits and $100 limits and things like that, but they're still advantageous to the bettor. We're also going to see that maybe sports books will say, okay, what if we are the low vig sports book? In other words, instead of dealing minus 110, we're dealing minus 105 or lower. And they could try to compete that way to try to drum up some business.
Increasing volume by being the low vig book is what you're saying.
Exactly. Gotcha. Trying to generate more traffic, because in the end, that's really what they want. They want more traffic, more sustainable traffic. Whereas before, they wanted just their customer database to be the biggest possible number that they could then tout to their investors. But now it's, we need to sustain that traffic. And the way to sustain it is to give people something that isn't giving the store away, but it's still giving them good value for their betting dollar.
Another example of this, you had a great column about it yesterday on unabated.com, micro betting. What's micro betting?
Yeah, so this is something I keep saying, this is coming. People say, well, what is micro betting? And you got to stop and pause and go, oh, you know what? People might not know what micro betting is. Well, micro betting is when you bet on something that is just a slice of the game and not necessarily referring to the outcome of the game. So for instance, I'm going to bet on what this next at-bat will be, whether it'll be a hit, what kind of hit it'll be, whether the player will make an out, the outcome of the next offensive drive by a football team. Will this player make one free throw, both free throws, no free throws? That sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing that I think a lot of bettors are going to want to be engaged with. It's sort of a fun way to bet and bet on something that isn't necessarily who's going to win the game. You can kind of make your bet. You get instant gratification as to whether you won or lost, and you move on. And for the sports book, well, they love it because they're turning you into a high-frequency betting machine. You're going to be making more and more bets, and the more and more bets you make, the more the house edge grinds into you. So, it's a good and a bad thing for sports bettors. I think some bettors are going to really like it as they watch the game. It'll help them kind of engage with the game. And sports books are going to love it because they can have these bets that you're constantly making more and more often. Sort of like how you go into a casino and the slot machine is very advantageous for the house because you're making bets more frequently. And that's sort of what micro betting will be. It's more frequent bets.
Is the technology where it needs to be for that? Because, for instance, I have Hulu TV. I watch everything, all the games I watch. They're almost all on more of a delay than you would get on, say, cable. So, for instance, if I'm live betting now, I'll only do it during like a commercial, a timeout, something like that. I can't imagine with my current setup being able to micro bet in that way. For instance, the next pitch is going to be a ball, what have you.
Exactly, Josh. And that's been part of the problem as to why micro betting hasn't taken off is because, well, it's a bit unreliable in terms of betting on something that is currently happening when everyone's watching it in different ways. If you're at the stadium, you have an advantage. If you're watching on Hulu with a streaming device, maybe 30 to 60 seconds behind, you have a huge disadvantage. So what they've done is a lot of it is you're betting on things that haven't occurred yet, but will be occurring. So in other words, we're in the middle of an inning, let's say going into the bottom of the fifth. You're not able to bet on the first batter that's batting in that inning. You're able to bet on the second batter. That way they know that there's no chance that they're caught behind or you're caught behind. It's more of like a slightly in the future type of thing. Now that varies by sport. Obviously there's going to be situations where it's a little bit sooner than later, but they're working out a lot of that technology. I think we're going to see some gains in technology, especially in the broadcast and streaming of games going forward. The NFL has already indicated that they want to become a streaming platform provider. Maybe they will look to solve a lot of the latency issues now that they'll have kind of a skin in the game. So it's interesting to see where this technology will evolve to.
Last one of these. This one intrigued me. You also urge sportsbook operators to focus on the, quote, meaty middle of the consumer distribution. I think I might be a meaty middle guy, Captain Jack.
Well, that would be great if you are, Josh, because the meaty middle is where you want to be as a sports bettor that knows they're not the sharpest of the sharp. They know they're not going to win great sums of money. They just want to be sustainable. They want to be able to bet on things. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. But when they lose, overall, it's a very small percentage amount. And here's the problem. Sportsbooks don't necessarily want that. Sportsbook operators, they want you to lose a lot. And that's not a matter of greed. That's just a matter of sustainability on their end in terms of the margins. So if you were to bet on a standard baseball, football, basketball game, you're mostly betting into about a minus 4.5% edge, which means over the long run, you will lose 4.5% of whatever you bet into it in the long run. Sportsbooks would rather have you lose at a 10 to 15% rate to cover all of their various expenses. And that was the rise of things like same game parlays, which have a higher house edge that's kind of hidden in there to make people think that they're getting a good bet, but they're actually betting into something that has a high house edge. So we know that sportsbooks don't want winners, unfortunately. And we know that they want this customer that's going to lose it at a very fast rate. But what about that meaty middle? In other words, if you had a distribution curve, and we know that the peak of that distribution curve, that bell curve, is around a -4.5%, what about all those customers that are between -5% and maybe -2%? Maybe they do a little line shopping and they're able to kind of get that house edge down to like just -1% or -2%. That's a very sustainable customer. And as a result, sportsbooks should want that customer, but they tend to not. They tend to go ahead and try to find the guys that are losing a lot faster. I think sportsbooks should cater towards the guys like you and I that would be in that meaty middle and would be a better that could sustain them long term, because we're not losing our bankroll as fast. We're able to replenish our bankroll and we're a more sustainable resource.
You're a way, 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 way better gambler than I am, Captain Jack, but thank you very much. I appreciate that. Another context in which you have discussed offering a more competitive product lately is in regards to the American Gaming Association's ongoing efforts to get the DOJ to crack down on the offshore betting industry. We had a rep of the AGA on to talk about this a little while back. I thought of you a lot during this, Captain Jack, during the interview, because I push back a little bit here and there, but not much at all. It is really important to me that everybody who comes on this podcast is comfortable and has a good time. So I didn't go into it too deep. However, I don't know if you listened to that one, but I could picture your head exploding. You listened to the interview.
Yeah, okay. I did.
Yeah, I could picture your head exploding during some of it. So now that I've got you on here, I want to give you the opportunity to respond to some of it. I'm going to play you a clip. This is Chris Silkey. He's a senior VP over at the AGA. And I had asked him about sharp bettors being limited at legal U.S. books and then going offshore, not because they want to, but because they feel like they have to. Here's the clip. It's from April.
I think that there's probably a very small universe of those people that are exceeding the kind of bet limits or placing large wagers that our member companies wouldn't accept. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Certainly it does exist, as you've heard from some universe of these people, but I would imagine it's fairly small for most of us. It sounds like for you and for me as well. Sports betting is a fun thing, and we're placing, you know, reasonably sized wagers that are going to be accepted, probably losing more than we win, and so the sports books are happy to take our money at every turn.
Jack, what do you think?
So I remember Chris saying that, and he was referring more towards this, that there are these bettors that want to bet more than the sports book could possibly take. But that's not the case with a lot of sharp bettors. We're not able to place even reasonably sized wagers, you know, $100 even, which I think any bettor would say, well, that's not ridiculously large for a $1 billion company to fade somebody's $100 wager. But they limit us down to $3.62, kind of an insulting amount just to kind of drive home the fact we don't want your action. We're just even going to, this pocket change that we found in the couch is all we're going to let you have at this wager. Look, the AGA is a lobbying organization. They are paid to provide a spin on things towards the constituents that they cover, the casinos and sports books that pay their dues to the American Gaming Association. I can't fault them for that, Josh. That's their business model. What I can say, though, is that the bettors are not very represented in this ecosystem. Okay, we have the casinos and operators are able to have their voice heard through their lobbying organization. The anti-gambling people are able to have their voices heard through various nonprofit organizations as well that rally to, you know, preach out against sports betting and the proliferation of betting in general. And of course, we have the states are able to be heard in terms of what they would like to see. But the bettors, actually, the guys like you and I who are actually out there doing the betting, there's really no trade organization for us. My partner at Unabated, Rufus Peabody, and I, we actually went down the road of trying to build a nonprofit organization that would be a voice for bettors. And we didn't get very far because we just didn't have the amount of money and support from the industry to go about it. In fact, one very prominent operator said, "We don't think there's a need for this. We feel like the players already have enough of a voice." I don't know where that voice is coming from, but I haven't heard it. But the point being is, look, the AGA may think that they have their overall unbiased view of the industry, but they're biased by nature. And limiting is an issue. It's not a widespread issue. There's probably a lot of people that have never been limited, but it is something that pops up for a lot of people, especially if you attempt to get an edge, especially if you try to go down the path of trying to win at sports betting. Eventually, you're going to get limited by somebody.
Earlier in the interview, we talked about some books potentially leaning more towards the sharp model, as you described it. Do you ever see a world in which sharp bettors who make their living gambling, are able just to rely on legal books in the U.S.?
I hope so. I think we're getting closer. There has not been any regulations put into place in any state that would prohibit bettors from winning. We've seen that in other jurisdictions around the world, that they've basically passed laws that say, yeah, you can bet on sports, but you can only lose. You can't win. And we haven't seen that in the U.S., so that's a good thing. We have these new books coming online that are going to at least take a stab at this. Now, for the average consumer, they may offer a little less at some of these sharper books than they're used to. There's not going to be all the wacky props. There's not going to be all these promos and bonuses out the wazoo offered every week that a lot of people are taking advantage of. So for some people, it's going to be a little bit of a disappointment. They're going to call these books a little vanilla, a little bland. However, this is good for the overall industry in terms of rounding out the ecosystem. And then the other part of the ecosystem, Josh, is the exchange concept, sort of blending in how financial markets work with how sports betting works. And it's not a one-to-one relationship, but there can be correlation between the two. And so we're going to have exchanges start to rise up in the U.S. Now, they won't have interstate liquidity across state lines. They're going to have to be all within one state at a time. But they're going to allow sports bettors, especially high-end sports bettors, to kind of get in and out of positions and put up offers as to where they think the market will move so they can get some other sharp money or other recreational money coming against them within the exchange itself. It's sort of like they become the sports book. And exchanges generally have a lower margin. They have a commission instead of really a VIG. And they can be very advantageous to bettors, especially sharp bettors. And that's going to help to kind of round out the ecosystem for some of the higher end bettors, as well as some of the sports books.
I don't want to go too far off the beaten path here, but I am really interested in exchanges. If listeners want to learn more, this would kind of be like Sporttrade, right?
Yes, Sporttrade is one. The Profit Exchange, Bet Profit, is also coming to New Jersey shortly. That'll be another. These companies are big. They have millions and millions of dollars behind them. They have market access deals. They have market makers that are going to provide liquidity. So this isn't as player to player as it sounds. It's more of like some really big players versus some smaller players in terms of liquidity. And I think it's also going to drive price discovery in terms of knowing what the sharp price is, because these exchanges are going to hammer it into place a lot faster for bettors. And that's a double-edged sword, right? The bettors are going to be able to see market efficiency taking place, but at the same time, at the sacrifice of market inefficiency drying up a lot faster.
Back to offshore books for a second. I know you saw FanDuel CEO. Forgive me, it's Amy Howe, right? Amy Howe. She recently estimated 25% of offshore customers will never see their winnings paid back. What'd you think of that, Jack?
Yeah, I was quick to do a snarky little comment on Twitter, as I often do. However, it was explained to me, and this story hasn't gotten out as much. She was misinterpreting some data she was given by FanDuel researchers, and they had found that 25% of customers had issues at one time or another cashing out offshore. That number is far more believable. My counterpoint to that would be that's probably also the same percentage that have had trouble cashing out in regulated environments. Now, in regulated environments, they're almost sure to get their money. It's not like they're just going to be given a runaround for no reason. the regulated environment has a lot of AML, anti-money laundering, and KYC, know your customer, regulations that they have to follow. So sometimes you get asked to send a picture of your ID or a utility bill, or the worst is when they make you send what I call a hostage photo, where it's you holding your ID next to your face with the current date in the other hand, like you're some kind of proof of life for a hostage video. The point being is there are a lot of runarounds in the regulated environment as well. So it's tough to really say that 25% offshore is that different than what people have seen onshore.
Are you worried? This is something that's come up a bunch lately, and that's why I'm asking the question. Are you worried about match fixing and specifically efforts to combat match fixing?
Josh, I'm not as concerned about match fixing, especially with U.S. sports. U.S. sports are very well regulated. I'm worried about the perception of match fixing, and you only have to go so far as the Home Run Derby this year. Yeah. There was a lot of confusion if you watched the broadcast of the Home Run Derby. Was a home run missed? You know, the announcers are calling them, but they're not really paying a whole lot of attention. They got a million things going on. The on-screen graphics are lagging behind. The next pitch is coming while the ball is still in the air. So as a result, there was a lot of people that felt like, you know, oh, did Kyle Schwarber not have a home run counted? Did Pujols get one off after the buzzer? Oh, it went around and around. And the word fixed started to get used in what people were talking about with the Home Run Derby. And people were betting a lot of money on the Home Run Derby, apparently. So that's not good for anybody. That's not good for the league. That's not good for the industry. That's not good for sports books to have to answer these questions. So I don't know how best to answer that, except that you need to be able to make sure that your regulations as the league are airtight and your rules are airtight and they're followed, because people are betting real money on this. So you need to make sure there's no doubt of any kind of unscrupulous activity going on in your league. That's easier to do for a major league like our four major league sports. That's harder to do if you're a minor league that doesn't quite have the resources to have all of the camera angles and everything to suss things out. So it's a little bit tough for smaller leagues, but there's really no excuse for a larger league. And so I hope that in the future we get to the point where people don't have to doubt the integrity of a match or a result.
One of the ideas that has been brought up is that perhaps major books should not take bets on very, very small scale leagues. I'm just totally making this up. I don't have a good example, but like Russian ping pong or what have you, bets shouldn't be offered. You have any opinion on that?
Right. So, you know, that grew out of the pandemic when we had no major sports. We all started to turn to these minor worldwide sports, and Russian ping pong just grew out of the blue, and it fit a need for a lot of sports bettors, and that was the need to get action down. But it was very suspect as you watched it. You started to have some concerns as to, wait a minute, wasn't this guy named somebody else yesterday wearing red shorts?
Right.
Right. It was, you know, so the states have control over this, though. They can say which things are allowed to be bet on and which things aren't. And there's always a demand for, I want to bet on this. I want to bet on this. The hot dog eating contest. People want to bet on that. A lot of states have said, okay, yeah, you can bet on it. That's a little risky. The draft is a huge betting opportunity now. And it's really tough for operators because there are people that know what a team is picking because they're part of that team. They're part of the draft room. And that can impact, you know, thousands of dollars going back and forth. So I think states need to maybe take a little bit of a harder line and not be so willing to let's bet on everything. But the problem is, Josh, if a state declines to offer a betting market on it, there's always offshore. They're always ready to jump in there and give you a line on something that a state won't give you a line on. So it's a tough decision for a state to decide which is better, to take the risk of regulating this market or take the risk of having somebody else take their money offshore.
Sometimes there's a neighboring jurisdiction too. For instance, can't bet on the draft in Virginia. About the only time I bet in DC is draft, that type of thing. We're gonna get to the locals here in a minute, Jack. You knew I couldn't pass up a full interview with you and not ask about my own little area here. Before we get there, even football on the horizon, as you know, us recreational gamblers love nothing more than betting on the NFL, even though it's some of the most efficient lines you can possibly find. Take as long as you need with this one. Do you have any advice for how bettors can go about betting on NFL football this coming season? So I'm looking for process here. Right? Okay. I'm not looking for fished. Give me some pointers on how to fish, Captain Jack.
Okay. I love this question, Josh, because too often I get asked for, okay, at the end of this podcast, you give me your picks for the following week. And I always push back and I say, look, I'm not a pick guy. If I was a pick guy, I'd be living and dying by my picks. 45% of the time, I'd look like an idiot because I'm going to be losing about 45%, winning hopefully around 55%. Here's the thing. Betting on sports doesn't have to be about picking winners. In fact, that's probably the worst way you can possibly bet on sports is just trying to pick winners, trying to pick the winner of every football game on the docket. Worse yet, parlaying them all together. That's just a fool's errand. What you should be doing is looking for ways that are easier for you. For instance, picking the winner of a game might be harder than picking whether this quarterback is going to have a good game. Maybe they're going up against a poor pass defense, and you can say, oh, he's going to have a big passing game. Even if they're winning, he's probably going to have a good passing game. And maybe that team they're going against is weak across the middle, and you say, oh, well, the tight end is going to have a great game. I'm going to bet the over on the tight end. Or conversely, maybe the middle linebackers are super strong, and that tight end is he's going to get slaughtered going across the middle. You bet the under on the tight end. Things like that. You break the game down into a smaller subset, and when you have a smaller subset, there's less variables involved. You're not worried about what the bounce of the ball on a fumble late in the game down at the goal line, that sort of thing. That's irrelevant to you. So try to break a game down into a smaller subset, and that way make it easier on yourself. Another great way to get an edge at football is not let yourself be the handicapper, but let some of the sharper sports books out there in the market be the handicapper. Look, sports books exist on a spectrum of sharpness. There are some really sharp books in the world, and there are some books that are just recreational. They're just taking money. They're slow to move their lines. And you can find who these sharper books are and find what they have as the price, and then find where the price may be less at another competitor, another sports book. So, for instance, at the site that I have, unabated.com, we have an odd screen, and we have up on our odd screen market-making books. In fact, we've curated a collection of their pricing into what we call the unabated line, and that is like a weighted average of the market-making books for each sport. And that'll give you a vig-free line. So, in other words, if the line is minus 130 on one side and plus 100 on the other, we'll give you the vig-free line of like minus 119 or whatever that would work out to be, so that you can say, okay, this is the true probability of this team winning. And I see over at Sportsbook XYZ, instead of betting minus 130 or even that minus 119 true probability, I'm able to find minus 105. That gives me an edge because we know that the true probability at minus 119, which is like 54.5%, you're able to get it at minus 105, which is like 51%. So it's almost like something should be $54 and you're paying $51. You know you have $3 of value in the market. That's sort of like consumer price shopping 101, right? So you use that. It's called the top-down methodology. And Josh, there are people that have made a fortune, basically, using the top-down methodology of letting the sharper book dictate what the price should be and betting it at the cheaper price elsewhere. And people that aren't involved in sports betting, people that weren't sports fans to begin with, they have just stumbled onto this top-down methodology. They pick off the inefficiency in the market, and then they just wait and see what happens. They don't have to sweat it out or anything. And over time, that value adds up again and again and again, and they profit from it. And it's a great way to bet on sports if you don't actually want to have to slave over trying to figure out who's going to win this matchup at this point spread. It's just a better way to do it.
It's fantastic advice, and I recommend everybody give it a try as NFL season rolls around for all my fellow degenerates out there. Okay, before I let you go, Jack, quick local betting roundup. Last year, you told me, I thought very charitably, that the DC betting market was getting better. Since then, they had the colossal Super Bowl blunder. People couldn't bet on the Super Bowl on the app that day. They have had recent roundtable discussions with local politicians about what's happening over there. The DC Lottery claims that they're starting to have more competitive offerings. I look at the offerings all the time. It's a little bit of a yes and no, if I'm being real about it. What do you think? Where's DC at now? Are you optimistic? Are you down? What do you think?
Well, if you recall, Josh, I was optimistic because there was some competition coming into play. We had BetMGM at Nationals Park. We had the Caesars book at the Capital One Arena. We had various pockets of other operators you could get within the DC metro area. And then we had competition coming in from Virginia. And then we had competition starting to germinate in Maryland. It's still germinating.
That's my next question.
I thought that's put some pressure on them. The app still is lousy. They really need to kind of come to their senses and realize that they were sold a bill of goods that just isn't possible. And maybe think about finding a way to negate a lot of their contract and maybe move on to another operator or see if there's other ways they can fix it. Because right now they're still not quite offering a competitive product. And it's a shame because it's the only product that DC residents have access to unless they're in one of those little hotspot zones around one of the sports parks. So I don't know what the future holds for DC. I'm glad to see that the councilmen and women have started to realize, oh, we made a mistake here and we need to fix this. But I don't know how big of a priority it's going to be going forward. There are bigger issues in DC than the sports betting app. So if you're a DC resident, hopefully you can still kind of be a little bit mobile and get over the line to bet in Virginia or possibly soon in Maryland so that you can, get a taste of what better sports betting is like.
In Maryland, mobile betting still is not an option. When we spoke last year, I personally absolutely thought it would be up and running by now. Recently, the governor, Larry Hogan, has publicly come out and said he wants it up and running by football season. We had John Martin, the director of the Maryland Lottery, which is one of two governing bodies with oversight. They're not the only ones. He was a little less bullish on this being ready by the start of football season. What do you think about mobile still not being good to go, Jack?
It'll be tough for them to get up and running by football season. They've just taken too much time in awarding licenses, stating regulations, things like that. Look, we've seen it go all over the spectrum in terms of how fast states can move. Look, Pennsylvania, they're up and running now, but when they passed their law to when they took their first bet, 14 months went by. New Jersey, when PASPA was repealed, they only took 5 weeks to get up and running. We've seen other states that have been fast and other states that have been slow. It just depends on priorities, right? So at this point, no, they're not going to make NFL week one. Hopefully they can make sometime during the NFL season, because getting any part of the NFL season is better than waiting until like January 1st, which is largely after the season. There's maybe 1 week left at that point. But it would be in a new calendar year and it'll be a nice clean start. No, January 1st is not a good start time. But hopefully, look, Maryland has the opportunity to be a very competitive market, maybe up to 60 different operators in that small state, which would be great. I would hop on I-95 and I'd be down to Maryland and I'd be shopping all over the place. But it's yet to be seen how they're going to roll it out. At this point, just west of us in Ohio, they seem to be getting all their ducks in a row in a very timely manner. They're shooting for a January 1st shotgun launch where everybody starts on the same day. Heaven help those regulators that have to deal with starting on a national holiday and all on the same day. That'll be tough for them. But point being is at least they've got a plan. And I would love to see Maryland at least come out with a plan. And at this point, I really think they could say November 1st, December 1st, and hit it. But it remains to be seen if they're going to.
Whenever it does happen, any idea what sign-up bonuses promos might look like in Maryland or other states that are launching?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit decreased. They'll still be decent, though, because they're still trying to pick up a new market that hasn't already signed up with an operator in another state. You know, if you sign up with DraftKings or FanDuel in Virginia, you can't just drive over to Maryland once they open up and get a new account there. Your wallet follows you over. So you're going to be limited in the number of sports books that allow kind of a re-sign-up process. But there's going to be new operators in states like Maryland that have a very competitive potential industry. So there's that. Will the deals be as big as they were last year? No, they won't. But they'll still be decent. It'll be decent enough that I would encourage anyone who's listening to this, living in Maryland, go ahead, wait. When it launches, sign up for every book. Whether you think you're going to use them or not, at least play through the sign-up deal. It's literally free money. And in this day and age, you need every dollar you can get, right? So let the sports books subsidize you a little bit when they start. And then you can decide which books you want to play with long term.
Rest assured, Captain Jack, whenever Maryland Mobile does get up and running, you will be hearing from me again, my man, whether it's for the podcast, maybe even for Fox 5 DC on TV again, because you have been on Fox 5 DC with me before too. Can't thank you enough. I love our guests. Few that I enjoy talking to as much as I enjoy talking to you, Jack. Where can listeners find you? Plug away.
All right. So you can find me on Twitter at CapJack2000. But you can also find me on the site that I mentioned a little bit there, unabated.com. We have tools and resources for aspirational bettors. So in other words, if you have been betting and you say, you know what, this isn't cutting it, I need to get better at this, we're going to help you either win or at least lose less. We're going to give you some tools and resources and the education to kind of raise your game to the next level. And there's a lot of people that have joined our site. It's not free anymore. We do have a paywall, but they're finding a lot of value out of using our site to cover the monthly cost as well as generate some profit. And we do have a lot of things on our site that are still free. So it's not like you know, just because I said there was a paywall, you shouldn't come see it. There's plenty of things for free. We're going to add more as we get into football season because we know that consumers like to absorb football content. So we're going to have a lot of free content to get traffic up on our site. So unabated.com, go ahead, check it out. And you know, probably the best place to reach me other than that is we have a Discord server, which is free at Unabated. You can find the details on our site. I'm on there literally 24/7, Josh. I'm on there 24/7 answering anybody's question that asks. So there's a lot of good content there that you can find.
Really good stuff on your YouTube channel too. I know you have some videos on Unabated as well, but for people who are casual, looking to get more serious, or if you're just starting out, Captain Jack's got some really great content that's already out there that you can check out. It'll make you better.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I have not put out any new videos in a while, but the stuff that I put out during the pandemic back in 2020, a lot of people still resonate and say, wow, this is great. I'm learning so much from this. And this is a good 2+ years after I actually put it up there. So Captain Jack Andrews on YouTube, and go ahead and help yourself to watching all the content that's up there.
Captain Jack Andrews, unabated.com, the guy we call in for all the big shows. Thanks again, man.
Thank you, Josh. Always a pleasure.
It is now my absolute pleasure to welcome Mo DeKeel onto the show. Mo does podcasts for The Athletic. He writes for Bleacher Report. He also spent 8 seasons as video coordinator for the Clippers and the Spurs. More about that in a few. Thanks for coming on, Mo.
Thank you guys for having me, man. I always enjoy popping on.
You just got back from Summer League in Vegas, right?
Yes, Vegas wears you down.
Okay. So I'm betting that we have a ton of listeners and myself as well who would love to go to Summer League but never have. What is that experience like? Because you listen to some of the guys describe it, and it sounds like there's just this never-ending stream of NBA people, players, coaches, media, agents, everybody just coming and going at all times.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Summer League is kind of where the NBA community almost meets up at the end of the season. It's, you know, basketball for the younger players, from rookie, second-year guys trying to make rosters, to coaches coaching for the first time, and assistant coaches getting their chances to coach. And it's generally just really one big party at the end of the season. Ultimately, you know, a lot of work gets done. It's business as well. But, you know, it also just kind of turns into like, hey, you bump into everybody everywhere. You know, obviously at the arena, you know, they do a great job, the NBA, putting on the Summer League at Thomas and Mack. It grows every year. There are two gyms going on at the same time. You bump into people all the time in the concourse as you're walking through. And it could be anything from, hey, you bump into your favorite writer or podcaster to, oh, wow, Sam Presti just walked by me, or, you know, whatnot. And I think there's a lot of interesting things you kind of find across the board there. I think for fans, it's really exciting because you're also going to get to watch a ton of games and really the future of the NBA. Like, there's not going to be a lot of places where you're going to be able to catch Chet Holmgren, Paolo Banchero, Jabari Smith, and whoever else, you know, several other rookies all at the same day, you know. And I think that's the stuff that's really kind of fun about it. And Summer League's just a good vibe in general.
Is it true that at a Summer League back in the day, Chris Kaman took you to see the first Transformers movie?
Yes. You know, there's, when I was working with the Clippers, Chris was kind of just coming to support the young guys and things like that. And he took really the whole support staff. Like, you know, it was pretty awesome. It was fun. It was just, hey, like, it didn't matter. I had already seen the movie, but it was just along the lines of like, hey, it doesn't matter. Let's go watch it again. And just everybody meet at the theater at this time. Chris took care of everybody. We all went in and enjoyed the theater, a little bit of downtime. You know, this is the beginning of the moment where teams kind of get to relax a little bit, you know, support staff and things like that. So it goes a long way. And I think that's the fun stuff you get from Summer League sometimes, more on the support staff. That's something I don't think fans get to do as much.
That's awesome. I was always a fan of Chris Kaman's game. All right, let's jump around a little bit here, Mo. This is kind of going to be like NBA 20 questions, although I don't really have 20 questions for you, I don't think. And by the way, I meant to tell you this before we started the interview. I did add a couple things from the rundown I sent you. I don't think you're going to have any problems, though.
Just fire away. None of it. If it catches me off guard, that's a great question, then, and we'll figure it out.
My man, let's start with Russ. There were reports that Russ and LeBron were at the same Summer League game, but they never publicly acknowledged each other. Then there's a statement unlike I've ever seen before. Russ's now former longtime agent, Thad, I think it's Fouché, right? Is that how you say it? Thad Fouché, said that they were splitting up and that he thinks Russ should stay in L.A. So he's basically very strongly implying that Russ doesn't want to stay in LA. Then Monday night, Yahoo's Chris Haynes reported, no, it's all good. Russ, LeBron, and AD talked on the phone and they are committed to each other. Mo, what's going on here?
I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, Josh. All of my relationships get fixed with just one phone call. I don't know what you're really kind of alluding to. No, I think, you know, it's been kind of the drama of the Lakers. You know, the basketball hasn't been good this whole year, but the drama behind it has been great. And I think this has been a lot of fun with what we're seeing. And I think the ultimate thing is, I shouldn't say fun, but this is the drama behind it. And I think the situation, oh, LeBron, you know, and Russ don't meet. And it was kind of funny, like, hey, you know, all these guys went up to say hello to LeBron and Russ didn't go over and LeBron didn't go over to Russ. It kind of becomes a big thing. Sometimes I think we get that stuff a little bit blown out of proportions. Maybe it's bigger than I think in that sense. And that actually means something to the guys. But I think the bigger shocking stuff was the Russ parting ways with his agent. Now, it sounded like it was a mutual parting, but I've never seen a statement like that from an agent. And I think that was the stuff that kind of caught me off guard. It was, hey, we're having a difference of opinions. We don't see eye to eye. I think he should come back and, you know, should embrace the role that Darvin Ham is giving him. And it doesn't sound like Russ wanted to. And I think what I think from the agent perspective, which I find interesting about it, is his concern is everything we hear about a Russ trade is Russ is going to get bought out. He's not going to get traded anywhere. And I think the ultimate scenario about that is if he gets bought out, nobody's bringing him on for a big size contract, right? If he gets bought out, teams are going to look to sign him as a vet minimum. Once you get the vet minimum, it's hard to kind of get out of that at that point with Russ. And now you become, you know, one of those guys. And I think that's the challenge there that his agent was trying, I think, to explained to Russ in this scenario of like, you shouldn't really push for a trade. And you know, who knows what Russ is thinking with that? Who knows how the phone call went? But I just think ultimately, Laker fans better buckle up, because I just think Russ is going to be on the roster at the start of the season. I don't think there's anything that's going to really materialize that's going to open up an opportunity for them to get off of Russ. And I think that's something that they're going to have to kind of get ready to deal with at the start of training camp. Now, this phone call, great, great first step, you know, and I made a cheap joke because that's kind of what I do. But ultimately, you know, it's the first step, right? Like, if you're going to repair a relationship, you got to open up the lines of communication. And I think that's something there. And hopefully those three guys can start to kind of figure that stuff out.
Do you think either KD or Kyrie is traded this offseason?
No. And I want to put a caveat in there, unless, you know, a third team steps up. I think we in the media, fans, us playing NBA 2K on the trade machine, all these trades are easy to make when we're on the trade machine. We don't have to think about the cap ramifications, what this means in the long run for all those things. I don't think a team is out there that can present a package to Brooklyn that's going to be that enticing. We know that if it's Toronto, they're not going to make a deal with Toronto unless they're getting Scottie Barnes. It does not sound like Toronto's interested in moving Scottie Barnes from all the reports we've heard. And then on top of that, you know, I think the team that could probably put the most compelling package together, New Orleans, you know, centered around picks and Brandon Ingram. I just don't know if there's an appetite there for KD to want to go play in New Orleans, and vice versa. If New Orleans really wants to shake up what they have going right now, they had a nice run. They're going to get Zion back. Maybe they just want to kind of stick with the core they got. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting things there. Phoenix is just, they don't have it, you know, and now with DeAndre Ayton signing that offer sheet with Indiana and then going back to Phoenix, they can't trade him without his consent. And I don't see a trade happening there. It doesn't sound like Brooklyn was interested in the first place with the sign and trade. So I don't feel like they have the juice to make a deal happen. Everybody talks about Miami. Miami's going to be involved in all negotiations, but at the end of the day, they don't have the juice either. Like, I'm sorry, Miami fans, I love you guys. This ain't going to happen. You're not getting Kevin Durant for Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson and two draft picks. Like, that's something you might be able to pull off on 2K, but that's not something you're going to make happen in the real world. And if that were to happen, Sean Marks should resign right there and go move back to New Zealand, because he's never going to get a job in the NBA again.
Is Donovan Mitchell to the Knicks a when, not an if? Is it realistic that he could land somewhere else?
I think it's more of a when than an if, you know. And, you know, like, here's the thing, Josh, you've been around long enough. The NBA is crazy. A team could just come flying in out of nowhere and scoop him up. So I don't want to make it a guarantee, but I think it's more likely than not. I think, look, the Knicks brass was at the Utah Jazz Mavs games all through the playoffs. They weren't just scouting Jalen Brunson. You know, they were there for Donovan Mitchell as well, kind of poking their eyes out there, kind of taking a look and nosing around there a bit, to the point it kind of annoyed some Utah fans, and I would assume even the organization itself. I just think it's a matter of finding the right compensation and coming to a deal. It seems like a good fit in terms of Mitchell being from New York, all that stuff. The Knicks need a star. They're along the lines of being so desperate. And to kind of rewind a little bit to your previous question, it's the same thing with the Lakers' chase for Kyrie. You know, these teams are desperate for stars and trying to find a way to be relevant in that sense. The Knicks, after a nice run before to make the playoffs last year, failed to make it. They need to kind of make a run again here, and I think that's why they, in the end, I think will ultimately give the Jazz what they want.
You mentioned DeAndre Ayton earlier. Apparently, he's all good in Phoenix now after signing a max deal with the Pacers that the Suns matched. Clearly things have gotten pretty nasty there towards the end of their last playoff run. But then the story comes out Monday night, pictures of Ayton signing the deal. He's happy to be back. He's glad the business is over. Are you buying any of that?
Yeah. I mean, listen, man, 4 years, $133 million fixes a lot of things. I can get over a lot of things if you're going to give me that kind of money. I think, you know, it'll be fine. I think there'll be some smoothing out that they have to do and some fence mending they got to work on there. But I never believed Phoenix was not going to match the offer. There was no way they were going to lose DeAndre Ayton for nothing.
Assuming Aiden, Mo, is happy again, does that mean Phoenix kind of played this right? Because by matching Indiana's max as opposed to their own max, they're paying one less year. It's saving them. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's a big amount of money. It's something like $40 million.
Well, yeah, I mean, they didn't want to give him the 5-year max, I think, is the ultimate thing. And I think, you know, they did and they didn't play it right, right? Financially, yeah, they played it right. It worked out great for them. Go look at how last season ended. They didn't play it right on the court in that sense. Yeah, you know, it clearly led to issues with Ayton and him on the and the Suns on the court, and it hurt their chances. And that's one more year that you don't have. You didn't get a chance to win the championship. That means Chris Paul comes back 1 year older. That means you have a Devin Booker's got to carry a larger load. Bridges has got to carry a larger load. Cam Johnson, all these guys got to step up and things like that. You know, and on top of that, that was your window, because now, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it, but the West has gotten even deeper with some guys coming back from injuries and assuming everybody has good health. The West has gotten tougher. And I think that's something that you got to kind of pay attention to. So, yeah, they played it right financially. They're going to save some money. Also, it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in 4 years. If Ayton's going to play it sort of the way Gordon Hayward did with Utah when he was upset that he didn't get the deal he wanted with Utah, signed an offer sheet, I think it was with Charlotte, and then the Jazz match, and then cool, first chance he got, he bolted. I think that it wouldn't shock me if 4 years from now, and that's going to be when Ayton's like, what, 26? He's a baby. It's you know, you're going to be losing out on his prime. So we'll find out really in the long run how it plays out, if it worked out for them. But in the short term, financially, yeah, on the court, not so much. And we'll see if they can mend the fences. I think that's a big part right now. Like, that's got to be something on Monty Williams's plate right now, going like, cool, I got to go have a few dinners with DeAndre and hang out with him.
Talking about signing a contract and potentially bolting down the road, I'm scared to ask this one. I'm a Wizards fan. Uh-oh. What'd you think of the Bradley Beal deal?
I didn't like it. And it's not, first off, if I'm Bradley Beal, I am taking that money every chance I get, right? That's generational wealth type of stuff. That stuff you can pass down, all of those things. I have no problems with what Bradley Beal did. But I just don't know what the Wizards are thinking they're going to be now. You're not a team that's a championship contender right now. You're not a piece away from being a championship contender. You've now tied up so much money into one player, and you also have Kristaps Porzingis. You have a lot of pieces there. You have money tied up into so many different places, and you're not going to be anything more than mediocre at best. And I won't be surprised if they don't make the playoffs and things like that. And I think there is an element of concern when you're saying, hey, after a year, is he going to demand a trade? Like, I think that's a problem. And I think also, and this is going to be jumping on my soapbox, Josh, and this is what happens. I get kind of long-winded. I also think this shows a problem with the super duper max or fun max or whatever you want to call it. I think we're punishing teams for, hey, like, we've developed a player. We've cultivated a player. He's been here for 10 years. Clearly, at least for this year, for whatever reason, you know, financially, Bradley Beal wants to stay. We shouldn't have to be penalized, you know, in that. And I think in the next CBA, I won't be surprised if we see something along the lines of, hey, you get the super max, but when you get traded, you lose that, you know, and it turns into a normal max or whatnot or things like that. I'm not smart enough to figure out how to make it fair for both sides, but I think there's going to be some more restrictions to go with the super max or something, or give the teams a little bit more of a break here. You know, and it may not be the same scenario with Beal and, you know, in that stuff. But, like, look at the Warriors, Bill. You know, like, Steph Curry and the Warriors have a great thing going. You want the guys to stay at the same team. You want to kind of build that continuity. But we punish these teams when they get that going with hammering them with the cap because they have to pay this, right? If the Warriors, for example, or the Wizards, for that matter, Bradley Beal's their star. If they balked at giving him the supermax, you know, he's going to be like, fine, trade me. You know, I want out. And I think that's a tough scenario for teams to be in, where it's hard to pay that money and then knowing that you're not going to be able to improve your team that much.
The film breakdowns that you post on Twitter, they're awesome. I really, really, really enjoy looking at them. And in particular, I thought you did an awesome job during Summer League pointing out some things that maybe aren't talked about as much as they should be among more casual fans. So, for instance, I really enjoyed your posts about Paolo's passing. You had some really good stuff about there out there about Jabari's defense. Any other Summer League observations that you think maybe aren't getting quite as much attention as they should get from the casual set?
Yeah, I think just starting with and everybody should know this to be fair and put my cards on the table. I don't watch college basketball. A lot of times this is me watching guys for the first time in a game setting. I try to do my homework for the draft. It depends on when the finals end and how much time I have and until the draft and things like that. But, you know, for me, like watching Paolo in that court vision, I wasn't expecting that. I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is not what the player I thought I was going to be watching. I was pretty impressed. So, kind of knew what we were going to see from Jabari Smith, was still pretty impressed. Chet Holmgren, I think his greatest skill is him kind of rotating from the weak side. I think his key development defensively is going to be, can he play free safety for the Oklahoma City Thunder? And I think a lot of that's going to depend on everybody around him, not just him. But if he's able to kind of be that guy to come over from the weak side, he's going to rack up a ton of blocks on a nightly basis. I think, you know, there is a lot of small stuff with guys. I thought I liked Tari Eason's motor. I think there's some fun stuff going on with the Rockets. But really, Josh, if you really want to get my thoughts on this past summer league, I'm really disappointed in a lot of the second year guys not showing up to play. And I don't understand it. I was very happy to see Josh Giddey play. And it was really important that he got to play with Chet Holmgren, start to develop that chemistry. I'm not asking these guys to play all summer league, but play a couple of games. I don't understand what the thinking of why Jalen Green doesn't play summer league. He hasn't played an NBA game since April. I don't understand why Franz Wagner wasn't out there with Paolo Banchero to start working on that chemistry there. I am shocked that Jalen Suggs didn't play. Yeah. If anybody needed a second, another run, and he didn't have a very good rookie season, and I was very high on him, shocked he didn't play. There are some guys I can give a pass to. Evan Mobley didn't need to play summer league. Anybody that he was playing with Cleveland, not really somebody that's going to be, they're going to be playing regularly with throughout the season and stuff like that. Nobody to really kind of develop chemistry. Annoyed Cade Cunningham didn't play with the Pistons because he needs to kind of get those minutes with Jaden Ivey. Should have gotten those. Now, granted, Jaden Ivey got hurt, twisted his ankle, didn't play much. But look at all the guys that did play for the Pistons. Isaiah Stewart, who probably didn't have to play, came out there to play because he knew he needed to stretch the floor and work on being a three-point shooter as a big man, and that's something that you got to watch for Detroit. I think I'm just surprised by the number of just second-year guys that just felt like they did enough to skip out on summer league. And I think that's going to hurt those teams. I think Oklahoma City is going to be a little bit ahead of those teams just in the pure sense of, hey, Chet and Giddey, we saw some great chemistry between those guys. I really thought that mattered a ton. And I think those are the things that are important. And I think a lot of those rookies who didn't play or sophomores going, guys going into their sophomores, it's that in between year. It's really weird. Yeah. Going into their sophomore season, I actually think a lot of those guys needed to play. A lot of them were sitting courtside. I'm like, yo, you need to have a jersey on and play. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. And if I was on the team side, I would just be like, this is a waste. We wasted an opportunity.
Some of those guys, like Cade, for instance, correct me if I'm wrong, but they do get to practice with the team, correct? Because technically they're on the roster, even though they weren't playing in the actual summer league games. Is that right, Mo?
Yeah. Guys can practice with them and do all that stuff. But you know, Josh, none of it compares to what you're doing in the game. And I'm not trying to say summer league compares to an NBA game, but it's a step above what you're going to get in practice. It's a step above the pickup games that you're going to get throughout the rest of the summer that we're all going to go crazy about when we see a video of, oh, look at this dude. Oh, he's killing it. And can't wait. This shows he's going to have a leap next season. None of that's true. You know, it may or may not be, but none of that's kind of a sort of guarantee of that. And I think this is the closest to what you can get in the summertime of an NBA game with referees, with fans, with things like that. I thought, again, missed opportunity, even for a guy like Cade Cunningham.
Is there a team that's going to be better next season than people realize?
It's funny because I just trashed Cade Cunningham, but I'm going to say this. You know, I really am high on him, and maybe I'm too high on him, but I think there's a lot of stuff to like about this team. I really like Jalen Duren, the guy they got from the Knicks in the trade on draft night. I think that's good. I'm high on Jaden Ivey. I think he does a great job of getting to the rim. I think he's going to be awesome on the second side where Cade Cunningham's going to have the ball. Swing it over to him, and he's going to attack a rotating defense. I think that's going to open up opportunities. He's got to be a bit of a better shooter. I just like everything that they have with them. Super young team. I think they're going to be exciting, fun to watch. And they were in a lot of games last year, Josh. They just couldn't close games. And I think that's the thing we got to watch for them. I'm very excited for this team. I think they're going to be a team that's going to surprise a lot of people in the regular season.
What do you think? Like play-in contention for Detroit?
I think that's something they can be right in that play-in mix. I think they could be right there in that mix. I probably bit off more than I could chew on other podcasts where I was saying like, oh, they can be like last year's Cleveland. And I kind of mentally forgot Cleveland was like, before the injuries, was third
yeah.
in the Eastern Conference. Like, maybe that's too high. But I think they could be in the run for play-in. And I think they got a lot of young talent there. I think Dwayne Casey's a hell of a coach. And I think he's going to get the most out of these guys. I'm very excited. I can't wait for the season, to be honest with you. I just think there's a lot of fun teams. Even the teams that we normally call bad are all really interesting. You look at Orlando with Banchero, going to be a lot of fun. Oklahoma City, going to be a lot of fun. I think they're going to be a lot better than people also realize. They could probably be on that list. I think Houston's going to be fun to watch. I'm excited.
How did you end up getting name dropped in Jamal Crawford's Six Man of the Year acceptance speech?
That's something you guys, Jamal's my guy. Jamal's my guy. One of the best human beings, you know, great basketball player, fun to be around, but just a genuine good human being. He was the guy who I would play basketball with after practice, you know, and when I say
really?
Basketball, we would play, but in the sense of like, he would shoot and I would play defense and he right. would score all the time. And right. I would just tell him like, well, I almost got that one type of stuff. But like, he was fun. He was the guy, you know, after practice, everybody kind of splits up to baskets. He was the guy I would kind of, you know, do a couple of things with from time to time. And, you know, he says it in the in his six-man speech, though. But, you know, one day he caught me and I had just done pulled an all-nighter. And I think he was just kind of, you know, blown away by that. And, you know, nice enough to drop me in that speech. And I shouldn't be – I feel bad because everybody on the support staff deserved the credit. Everybody works their butt off on the NBA side where people – there are so many people you don't know about, you don't hear about, that are working their tails off and – on in several departments. So, you know, Jamal was nice enough to drop me in this speech.
That is so incredibly cool. By the way, I just saw a clip of him. I mean, he still looks great. I think, was he Drew League the other day?
No, he has his own league in Seattle.
Oh, his own league. Okay.
He has his own pro-am in Seattle, and he's done it for a while. I mean, Jamal can just kind of step on a court and drop 40.
He looked fantastic.
It was kind of funny. I was a bit surprised during the unfortunate run of COVID that we had throughout the season where everybody was getting called up. I was surprised Jamal didn't get called up because, honestly, he's ready to go. You know, he loves to hoop. He's great. He's good in the locker room. I think, you know, it's along those lines. So it wouldn't shock me if somebody gave him a call up and he just, cool, let's go, and dropped 20 in the first game pretty easily.
That's a guy who could drop 20 years from now. Wouldn't surprise me. Then. During your time as video coordinator, so you were Clippers and Spurs, meaning that you worked under both Doc Rivers and Pop, correct?
Yes.
Okay, here's my last one for you. Can you give me one good story about either one of them? I don't care. Funny, unusual, inspiring, whatever. Give me a Doc or Pop story.
I'll give you my Pop story because it's my first day in San Antonio. So I got the job in San Antonio. I just I didn't come right away. I had actually planned a trip with my father that was going to take me out of summer league really before I even got the opportunity for the job. They were cool with it. They're like, hey, come in August, all good, all that stuff. I moved from LA to San Antonio. First day in the office, working in the video room, working on a small project and things like that. And the video room quietly empties out. And James Borrego was the head video coordinator at the time. So, you know, he kind of facilitated all the hiring. And I should note also, I never interviewed with Coach Pop. I interviewed with JB. I knew JB from a while back. We've known each other and things like that. I interviewed with Coach Budenholzer. He kind of gave the green light, got me in. But I never talked with Pop. Never had a word. Never shook his hand. Anything like that. Pop comes running in looking for JB, going like, hey, JB, oh. And I just turn around going like, oh, hi. Hi there, Pop. You know, and he just kind of looks at me going like, and you are? And I'm like, oh, well, I'm the new video intern and things like that. And he's like, you know, anybody want to tell me? I'm only the team president. I only run this place. Like, what's going on here? And then he storms out. I'm now going like, cool, let me just look up flights back to LA.
Oh my God.
Going to cost to ship all my stuff out. And then 2 seconds later, Pop comes running back in. Oh, I'm just messing with you. Of course, I know who you are. Welcome to the team. And, you know, he has that good nature about him. He has fun with that. But I looked at him going like, Pop, you can't do that, man. I know I'm young, but you almost gave me a heart attack. Like, what are we doing here?
I would die.
I did, you know, but ultimately, you know, but it's just Pop. Like, he's going to have fun. He's the rough exterior that we see in the interviews and things like that. It's nothing compared to the man I know. And he's awesome in that sense. And, you know, I always say, you know, I think he's the best coach in the NBA, best ever. That's a lot of company there, but I think he's the best ever. But I think he's a better man than he is a coach. And I think that kind of says everything about Coach Pop.
What a way to end it. That's a great story, Mo. Where can listeners find you? Plug away.
Oh, well, it's off season now, so I'm kind of just chilling a little bit. We're going to be doing some on and off stuff podcast schedule-wise. You can find me on the Athletic Podcast Network, on the NBA shows. I'm on Nerd or She-Ro. I'm on Basket Buds. I will probably have some stuff dropping here and there on Bleacher Report as, you know, things happen in the NBA. And just follow me on Twitter, MODAKHIL_NBA, and you'll always find my stuff from there. At this point, you might just get a lot of pictures of my dog.
Mo Tequila, this is great. My apologies because I went a little long. I was having too much fun talking to you. The Athletic, Bleacher Report, thanks again for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me. And it's not your fault. I'm just long-winded, so you kind of got—I sort of put you in a bad spot.
I enjoyed every minute. Thanks, Mo. There you have it, ladies and gents. The 50th episode of the Rambling and Gambling podcast is in the books. Thanks to Mo and Captain Jack, and of course Parrish, as always. We'll be back next Wednesday. Definitely expect a lot more football in our future. And you know, as we always say, thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing. IG at Rambling and Gambling. Email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.